Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello. The seasons, they are a-changing.
It happened overnight, didn't it? It went from being
balmy
to needing to put the heating on.
You kind of quite like this, don't you?
I do like the autumn, yes. Also, I don't know if this was true when you lived in the States, and I know the part of the States you lived, Massachusetts, is very...
Foliage.
Very autumnal, yeah.
The foliage is very famous.
Beautiful.
You know what I mean by foliage, don't you?
Yes, I know what foliage is, yeah. I know I left school at 16, but I think my vocabulary is okay.
No, I just think foliage, it's not a very common word. It reminds me of that Susie Dent thing we did about words that we don't get used there very much anymore.
Okay, okay. Do you have fond memories of the foliage?
Yeah, I always found the foliage a bit boring. I mean, the trouble is, it's like not really a kid's thing, foliage.
Maybe not, no. Maybe it's something you appreciate more in the autumn of your years.
Are we not in the autumn of our years, are we?
I don't think these are summer days.
Aren't we late summer? But I think I interrupted you on the foliage.
But you did, and what I was going to ask you is, did the Americans of your acquaintance decorate the house with a gourd display in the autumn?
Oh, gourd, I thought you were going to ask me this. Sorry.
Because my wife, who is American, she insists that it's part of her culture to leave gourds strewn around the house at this time of year.
Can I just say, what is a gourd, well, in truth?
I think it's like knobbly squashes.
I mean, really, I just don't... A fleshy, typically large fruit with a hard skin, some varieties of which are edible.
You will have seen that there's often a bowl of tiny pumpkins and squashes and these knobbly deformed gourds on the table. And you might have thought, oh, they're going to be having something revolting for dinner tonight. But no, they just sit there from, I guess, like the end of September until late November in various states of decay.
Do they go sort of mouldy?
Yes, a little bit.
Where do you procure your gourds from? I know that's what all of our listeners are desperate to know.
Well, I don't involve myself in the procurement process.
The import-export. Yes. Of gourds.
But this year it's escalated.
Oh, no.
Because she's decided that the gourd display shouldn't just be an interior thing. It should be exterior.
Outside your house.
Yes. And I love the creativity, but she doesn't necessarily have an eye for these things.
That's a sort of backhanded insult. I love the creativity. That's what you say to her. You don't need to say it to me.
Of course,
because
yeah,
I'm not going to be offended.
So she initially went out and just bought one pumpkin, like an enormous pumpkin.
That's not a gourd.
And she put it on the front doorstep and said
that was
her autumnal display. And I said, I don't think that constitutes a display. That looks to me like Amazon tried to deliver a pumpkin and we weren't home and they just left it there. So this has now multiplied. She's been adding to it over recent days. And now I'd say there are about a dozen squashes, small pumpkins and gourds littering our front doorstep.
All on the doorstep?
Yes.
How do people get past them?
You have to kind of shimmy, you have to shimmy climb over them. Yes, yeah. You have to straddle a gourd.
Yikes.
And you don't have any memory of this from when you lived in Massachusetts?
I think maybe like a pumpkin outside people's house, maybe. I mean, trick or treat is like a, I know we're a bit early for trick or treat, but trick or treat is a very big thing in the U.S. I mean, I'd never done trick or treat in Britain before. I'm not sure if I'd heard of it, actually. And then I was, in 1977, I was living there as a kid in the US, and it's taken very, very seriously, even more seriously than it is taken now, which is obviously, it's now taken much more seriously than it was 40 years ago here, but...
Yeah, and I feel like it's really killed off bobbing for an apple and penny for the guy.
Yeah, penny for the guys. You don't see anyone doing penny for the guy, do you?
No, and I'll be honest, I don't miss it. It wasn't that great.
What was the apple thing?
Bobbing for apples. So you get a big bin full of water and then people would have to try and get apples out of it with their face.
Was that an autumn tradition?
I think so. It all feels like it belongs around the same period of time and it's been...
Americanized.
It's been Americanized.
Now, are you going to be in the US for Halloween?
We're going to be in the US for some of half term visiting family, but yeah. I think we're going to be back for Halloween. Oh, here's another thing as well. So
you've got to dress up as a druid or something for Halloween.
That I wouldn't mind. So, yeah. So when you think of a Halloween costume, what are you thinking of?
Skeleton, ghoul.
Yeah, which is spooky things, right?
Yeah, spooky, yeah.
But in the States... They just treat it like fancy dress.
Right.
So it doesn't have to have any kind of witchy, horror-y, ghoulish quality at all. Fine. Sarah can do what she wants. But she's also impressed this on Eugene. And due to things that I've foisted on Eugene over the years, he wants to go for Halloween as Paul McCartney. We didn't want to discourage him. So Sarah's bought him a Sergeant Pepper suit off the internet. So all these other kids are going to be dressed up as, I don't know, a Harry Potter or a werewolf or something. And then Gene's going to knock on the door dressed as Paul McCartney on the Sergeant Pepper cover.
Well, I think that's about individuality, Jeff.
There's such a thing as too much individuality, though. Isn't this an occasion when a bit of conformity wouldn't go amiss?
Maybe there's some way you can have a sort of ghoulish element to the Paul McCartney thing.
I mean, there was that conspiracy theory that he died and that there were lots of clues, including the cover to Sergeant Pepper. So maybe that's the Halloween connection.
What are you going to be dressed as?
I was thinking maybe George Harrison.
Right. Should we talk about what we're talking about this week? I am so excited. When Rachel suggested this, I jumped at the chance.
Do you think she suggested it as a little treat for you?
Trick or treat. And I know you're so keen on this episode. We are talking about cold water swimming, or wild swimming, or open water swimming. Now, we have done it before, but this is going to be new and improved.
Redux.
We're going to be looking into how it's become so popular, into some of the benefits, how to stay safe when you're doing it. I was having a cold shower this morning and I thought I must ask our guests whether this is a good acclimatization technique, because I always have a cold shower now in the mornings. We're talking to Kate Rue, who is founder of the Outdoor Swimming Society, which has got incredible. It's like 166,000 members.
Unbelievable.
And she's got lots of interesting thoughts on the growth of open water swimming. We'll be welcoming back Professor Mike Tipton, who'll tell us about the science behind cold water immersion. I saw an experiment they did on somebody dunking them in some 12-degree water. I must say, it did make me think, what am I up to? And then finally, we're talking to journalist, author, and former Hampstead Women's Pond lifeguard, Nell Frizzell, about her love of swimming.
Oh, she's great. What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is I have something for... we like to watch.
Oh, what is it?
Lessons in Chemistry.
Aha, yeah, this is quite new, isn't it?
It's quite new, as you'd expect with me. It's based on a book, and basically it's about a female scientist in America in the 1950s and the prejudice she faces about being a scientist. She appears to become a sort of award-winning TV chef using her science, but I've only watched the first episode.
Uh-huh.
It's Brie Larson.
I think she's my favourite actor named after a cheese.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so as Justine said to me last night, as we watched the end of the first episode, it's kind of nice and unthreatening, you know what I mean?
So it's not got any of your triggers in it?
It's got no politics. Well, it has got politics, obviously, in a way, but it's not about the law. It's just kind of nice and easy.
Great, I'll give it a look.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, I've taken a leaf out of your book. When the world feels particularly bleak, I know sometimes you treat yourself to cute animal videos.
Oh, yes.
And I have recurated my Instagram feed so that it now is mainly videos of unlikely animal friendships.
Oh, unlikely animal friendships are so fantastic, aren't they? Give me your favourite.
Well, I like them all. I like it if you see a goat who's friends with a tortoise or whatever. there was one the other day where there was a chicken and a rabbit riding on the back of a dog, but I'm not sure how much the dog was enjoying it. And then I did see one which was claiming that a dog had formed a friendship with a fish. But again, I'm not sure how consensual it was for the fish.
I mean, you know, it's funny you should say this because I think it's Stuart Heritage who writes in The Guardian had something about a Netflix series called Baby Animal Cam.
Oh.
Which is two hours of just live pictures from, I think it's from a zoo in America, of baby animals. And they basically play it without any narration.
Wow. Well, between that and Lessons in Chemistry, I think that's next week's They Like to Watch podcast sorted.
Maybe you could interview one of the animals.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
To start our conversation, I'm delighted to say that we're joined by Kate Rue, who is founder of the Outdoor Swimming Society, author of the Outdoor Swimmer's Handbook. And I think you boast, is it 100 and something thousand members now, Kate? Is that right?
I think it's over 200,000 now, actually. It's
over 200,000 members?
Wow.
Yeah, gosh. It just keeps growing and growing. And I mean, I think on the last survey by Swim England, there was actually 7.2 million people in the UK who swam outdoors. So we've only got a fraction of the entire audience.
What, that is quite an audience. And what do we know what it would have been a few years back?
Well, when I started the Outdoor Swimming Society in 2006, it felt like hardly anyone was doing it. You know, there might have been people emerging from their beach huts into their regular swim spots, but it wasn't a trend. And when people started talking about wild swimming and calling it that, people used to write letters to me and say things like, you know, thanks for giving me an identity. Before, I was just the odd guy in the office that went into lakes, you know, and now I'm a wild swimmer. So, I mean, I would sort of say that there's been a huge change in the last 17 years, between hardly anyone doing it or people are doing it very locally, to it being recognised now or seen as, you know, a lifestyle and something that you might want to orientate your life around.
I certainly consider myself in that category.
What were the point? Where are the spikes? Where are the step changes?
Post-pandemic, possibly.
Well, there's definitely been one there. I mean, I think originally it was like David Walliams doing the channel, and there was Roger Deakin's Waterlog, and then we had a 10K swim in the Beijing Olympics. And there was quite a lot of things that were going on that just meant that it went into the public consciousness that this was something that you could do. And the idea of it being dirty, dangerous and illegal to it being something kind of delightful, free and something that you might want to try and do. I think that all happened in the early years. And then, yes, the pandemic was a massive boost, because with the instruction that you could go outdoors for an hour a day and all the swimming pools shut, I mean, people just flocked to their rivers and lakes in huge numbers.
Maybe you could just tell us, because there's lots of different terms used: wild swimming, outdoor swimming, cold water swimming. Just give us a little sort of beginner's guide.
We use the term outdoor swimming because it encompasses anyone who's swimming outdoors without a roof, i.e. a Lido swimmer, an open water swimmer. They might be the more athletic, competitive swimmers, and the wild swimmers. Your wild swimmers are doing it for nature. Your open water swimmers are often doing it for competition. Your outdoor swimmers can be doing a whole variety of things. And your winter swimmers actually sometimes are swimming, but in fact that term is getting misused a lot. That a lot of time it's dipping, it's about cold water therapy, it's not actually about swimming. You've got a lot of people just getting in and lingering. I don't know if that's what you're doing, Ed, in the ponds when you're waiting to like set records.
Are you lingering?
Are you lingering, or are you swimming?
I'm not a lingerer, I'm a swimmer. And what made you set up the Outdoor Swimming Society? Because you carried on outdoor swimming into adulthood, had you?
Yes, I carried on doing it. But then there came a point where I started doing it more, and I met a friend who wanted to go travelling around doing it. And when I began talking to people, I was in a freelance office in London at the time, and I discovered a third of the people in that office also swam outdoors all the time, but no one was having the conversation. I never intended the society to go on this long. We basically just wanted to do a few charity swims to as kind of stunts to get more people into it, just because we had a basically excess of sort of missionary zeal. You know, we really love doing it, and we're like, it'd just be really nice to share this. And actually, so many people keep coming on board who want to share that swim love that it's just continued.
And how much of it has been driven by all the talk about the health benefits?
Well, from our point of view, not very much. I would say the Outdoor Swimming Society is for people who just love it for loving its sake. It's a very amateur thing. And in a way, I found all of the health thing, this might sound really horrible to say, but it's almost a bit disappointing, because swimming gives you a very natural contact with nature. It gives you a very natural high. If it's something you're passionate about, you feel immense sense of freedom and joy from it. But it's another step to selling it back to people is something that does that. You know, if you're drawn to water and you want to get in, then it's fantastic. To turning it into something else that we consume for our own benefit almost misses the point. I just think, you know, our society is there to give people the information and inspiration they need to swim. But it's very much about self-responsibility. Does this make you feel good? Does this appeal to you? Do you want to do it? Great. Then here are all these other people that have got a load of ideas for you. But we're not trying to persuade anyone to do it to make themselves better. And I think it's a very different angle to come from.
We did an episode on access to nature a while ago, and the percentage was so low. The stats that they had was you can only swim in 3% of rivers.
That's not actually right. It's quite complicated. That's a simplification. The non-tidal stretches of rivers is something like 3%. Basically, what we have now is that our rights to swim are a hodgepodge. So as swimmers, we can assume the right to swim, and actually it's not legally clear that we don't have it in lots of places. Other landowners can assume we don't have the right to swim, but again, it's not clear that the law is on their side. And I think now swimming is so popular and there's so many people doing it, and there's this real cry to give us the right to roam and the right to swim, then what we're looking for is greater legal clarity, starting, for example, with reservoirs. I mean, I think getting a right to roam might take a while, although it's great that Labour say they're going to do it if they get in. But in Scotland, in 2003, the Land Reform Act gave swimmers the right to swim in 800 reservoirs overnight. If we had a piece of legislation like that, then we would get 2,000 more places that we were legally allowed to swim overnight, which would be fantastic. You know, they're often inland bodies of water, they're near large cities, and what's not to love, really?
Yeah.
And how much is, you know, the pollution in rivers, sewage and all that an issue?
Well, I think all swimmers would love to be swimming in crystal clear, pure water. There's been a lot of distorted messaging around sewage and swimming in order to raise the sewage problem up the political agenda. And when we surveyed our members, we found out that people logged one incident of sickness in every 9,024 swims. Okay, so, you know, we've had people that are swimming like all our lives, all in all types of water, and never got sick. So 100%, we want clean water. There are some places that are really affected. There's also many places that aren't. But I suppose the crucial thing is that as a swimmer, you're not as vulnerable to getting sick as the messaging is making out. It's just people aren't so bothered about river ecosystems as they are about the yuck factor of swimming in sewage. And that's why it's become such a popular story. We give people information on how to stay well, and it's really simple. Like, don't swallow the water. Don't get in if it looks icky. Wash your hands before you start eating. Do head up breaststroke. Dry your ears afterwards. Cover your cuts. We just sort of help people by giving them the information.
And if you're a novice, I mean, is it as simple as, you know, just jump straight in? Or at this time of year, for example, is it better to wait out the winter until it gets a bit warmer?
That's one of the shocking things that's happened in the last couple of years. So winter swimming used to be something that people only did after 2 or 3 years of being a summer swimmer. And then gradually they just didn't want to give it up and they'd sort of get further and further into autumn. Whereas what we've seen since COVID is people actually beginning their outdoor swimming journeys in the middle of winter. So I guess it's really just up to the individual, but there are risks of swimming in cold water. So, I mean, you do need information on your side if you're going to begin in winter.
You need to tell this one that, because he's very competitive. And when it gets really cold, Ed, you like to be the one who's staying in that pond the longest.
I'm used to it.
Sounds like Ed maybe knows what he's doing.
Nobody's ever said that about me before.
I think it's a very weird sort of society thing we've got going on at the moment. That people have become really competitive about cold, but not about heat. You know, we don't really have much of a culture of who can sit in the sauna for longer in this country. But since Wim Hof, there's a lot of competition about being really tough. I'm not tough at all, so I don't take part in any of that kind of nonsense. In fact, it's been such a liberation to me to just to decide that I only need to stay in for a minute or two over winter, and now I'm quite enjoying myself.
You swim throughout the winter, do you, Kate?
I am an episodic winter swimmer, in that I don't really love long swims during winter. They leave me feeling cold all day. And I think this is a message that I would really like to get across about winter swimming. There's been so much about how good it is for your mental health. And sometimes people feel the cold is such a purifier that if they're going through a difficult time in their lives, you know, they get into cold water and all the grief or the anger or the anxiety or whatever it is just like flows down the river past them. So there is that story and we're hearing that a lot. But honestly, I think there's far more people who get in and just find it cold, unpleasant and draining. And in a crisis moment, you know, in a crisis moment of their life, sometimes you need to be really gentle with yourself. You know, you don't necessarily always need to go and sort of flex your stoic muscles. So just do what feels right for you, I think. I went to Finland last year and got to take part in the going between a sauna and an ice pot.
Ah, is this contrast therapy? Is that what they call it?
Yes, but of course they don't call it contrast therapy. They're just Finnish people having a sauna and they haven't packaged it up as another wellness trend. But I suddenly realised that this was for me. As long as I can get hot again afterwards, then I do enjoy the freshening kind of cold, and I feel quite brave for getting in, because I mean it's a challenge below 6 degrees, isn't it? It's a physical assault, you know.
And so the Finnish thing is you go into the cold water and then you go into a sauna, is that right?
Yeah, it's up to you which order you do it in and where you finish. But I stayed with some artists over there in their sort of grandma's family cabin, and an entire evening would be spent going between the ice pot and the sauna. It was just fantastic. And by the end of it, I kind of feel like human honey. You know, you feel so relaxed by the whole experience. And I did come home thinking, us Brits have been really stoic. But I mean, we just go to, in Somerset, murky, muddy rivers, slip down the bank, you know, freeze in the water, come out, freeze in the cold air, and then shuffle off home again. I sort of think if we got into this sauna thing, we could be giving ourselves a bit more of a treat.
How long do you stay in the ice water for in Finland then?
Only a couple of minutes. I mean, it was, well, as you would expect, it was only just above freezing. I had to carve through 0.5 metre of ice to even create the pot that we all got in.
Kate, can I ask, do you see a lot of diversity across outdoor swimming? Because something we've talked about quite a lot, actually, on the podcast is when it comes to enjoying nature, often it's not reflective of the class and ethnic makeup of the country.
I live in the west of England, where 98% of people are white, so there's not much ethnic diversity here in the first place. If you go up to somewhere like Sheffield, where they have, there's a huge movement there to swim in reservoirs, obviously you see an awful lot more diversity there. I think the biggest thing is that you can't swim outdoors until you can swim. And what we do have in this country is absolutely appalling rates of people being taught to swim now when they are children. And there's a huge ethnic disparity in the children that are learning. And basically, if you've got white, middle class, reasonably affluent parents who swim, you're quite likely to end up swimming. If you're just reliant on state provision of swimming lessons, then you might not. One of the things about swimming that I love is that it is so age irrelevant. You know, you can do it as a child, but my swimming buddy's 20 years older than me and she's 73 and we're going on 10K swim adventures all the time. And I think you don't get that in so many sports.
Kate, it's brilliant to talk to you. We love the Outdoor Swimming Society. Maybe Jeff and I will go on location to Finland at some point. Kate Rue, thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, next, we welcome back to the pod Professor of Human and Applied Physiology at the University of Portsmouth, Professor Mike Tipton. Hello.
Hello there.
It's Dr. Mike. It's Dr. Mike.
Dr. Mike.
He's back.
Ed is, he's very giddy about seeing you again.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
It's been a couple of years, I think.
There's so many questions. And also, I tried to get his mobile number, Jeff, to get constant advice about my cold water swimming. But for some reason, he blocked my number.
Yeah, yeah. He emailed Rachel to say, under no circumstances, yeah, pass on this number to Ed. Since it was a couple of years ago, will you just remind us about your own experience as a cold water, open water swimmer?
Limited is the summary of that. We've spent 40 years researching what happens when people go into cold water, initially, particularly from a hazardous perspective, because, you know, we still lose somebody every 30 hours in the UK to cold water immersion, a child a week. So we've always been driven to try and keep people safe. In the background, however, has always been this idea of taking to the waters for your health, and some towns in the UK like Brighton and Penzance exist because of that. I mean, and going right back, even the Romans had a frigidarium, which was the cold bath, which people could go into. Thomas Jefferson, Darwin, Florence Nightingale, Hippocrates all talk about cold as a beneficial effect, but that was always in the background.
Me as well.
Miliband.
Darwin and Miliband said that it's good for you. And it took off, of course, during lockdown. Our local club in Perranporth here went from 25 to 1,000 members.
Now, let's start with the physiological effects, Mike. When you get into cold water, and I did actually watch last night a video of you doing this to somebody at 12 degrees, and I thought, gosh, that's what's happening. And he didn't look very happy, and that's what obviously happens to me, although we'll come on to acclimatization in a minute. But what processes are happening in your body when that initial immersion happens?
So everything you experience is driven by a sudden cooling of the skin. And about 0.18 millimeters below the surface of the skin, you have lots of cold receptors, about four times more cold receptors than warm in the skin. That output from those cold receptors, the dynamic response to the sudden change in skin temperature, drives that gasping, hyperventilation, blood pressure shoots up, workload placed on the heart goes up, lots of stress hormones released. It's part of the fight or flight response that is totally inappropriate in water, but prepares you to run away or fight on land. After that, that peaks in about the first seconds of immersion. But as the cold receptors get used to the cold water. They adapt to the new temperature. Once that's gone away, then your next tissues to cool are your superficial nerves and muscles. Those in the limbs are particularly susceptible. And that's where we'll see maybe after as little as 10 minutes in very cold water, people starting to swim fail. Can, you know, they start to feel stiff and they find that they're getting more upright in the water and their swimming is less efficient. You're not going to become hypothermic even in the coldest water as an adult in less than 30 minutes. So most of the problems, most of the risks which open water swimmers face that go in for a few minutes are to do with skin and superficial nerve and muscle cooling.
Is it better to get yourself in very, very slowly, like, you know, just let your ankles go in and then dip your elbows in and start just like splashing a bit of water on your chest?
Yeah, physiologically, yes. Psychologically, it's a bit more of a challenge going in incrementally. But that response I've just described, the cold shock response, is bigger the faster you go in and the more of the body surface area that's exposed. So going in quickly will produce a bigger cold shock response than going in slowly.
Can I just ask, so talking about my own personal experience, which of course I never do on the podcast, but just on this occasion, Jeff, you'll allow me. I was in last weekend and it was 15, and I actually found 15 absolutely fine, where I don't think I would have found 15 fine a few years back. I mean, presumably the more you do it, the more you get acclimatized.
Yes, absolutely. We've done studies looking at how long it takes as well. So in terms of the cold shock response, you can acclimatize. It takes as few as 6 2- or 3-minute immersions in cold water, and you can halve that cold shock response, and you can feel a lot more comfortable as a result. That reduction is still reduced by about 25% 14 months later. Well, we couldn't get anybody. We'd run out of friends 14 months later, so nobody would come back after that. The dangerous bit about that habituation is, even though the cold shock response will virtually, I mean, when we have people like Lewis Pugh come to the lab, because he does so much swimming in really cold water, when you put him into cold water and you look at all the medical traces, you can't actually spot where he went in. I mean, he's actually completely lost that shock, wow, cold shock response. But the word of caution is that you don't adapt to that physical incapacitation that follows once you get skin and nerve cooling. And also the other problem is that the fact that you feel more comfortable means that you can overstay your welcome, because you do feel more comfortable and you sort of think, well, I'll keep going. And what you've developed there is what we call a hypothermic adaptation to cold, where your body temperature can be cooling, but you just don't notice it because you've dissociated your body temperature from how you feel.
This is all sounding a bit grim. So you're suggesting there are sort of physical limits for how long you should be in, which are irrespective of how often you've done it before. Is there any kind of guide you can offer to that?
Well, the number one thing that comes from the stories we've just talked about is don't rely on how you feel and try and limit your duration by time rather than by any perceptual aspect. I think that probably the benefits that come from doing cold water immersion come from actually the first couple of minutes. So if you wanted to do this as little as you needed to do, I think you probably only need to be in for a couple of minutes just to evoke that dynamic response from the skin receptors. If you're in water temperature, that's, let's say, average for the British Isles, which is 12, then you've probably got 15 to 20 minutes before you start to feel that physical incapacitation. So the other thing is, if your limbs start to feel stiff, if you're not moving as smoothly through the water, if you're getting more upright in the water, then that's a really good sign to leave.
Can I ask about, with all the claims made about the benefits of it? I mean, there are all kinds of reasons to enjoy open water swimming, of course, but empirically, is there any benefit that you wouldn't get from a couple of minutes in a cold shower followed by whatever your regular choice of indoor exercise is?
That's a slanted anti-cold water swimming question.
I'm right in the middle of it between risk and benefit. And so I would say probably not, although a cold shower is not as potent a stimulus as an immersion. There is an enormous amount of anecdotal evidence out there that this is of benefit for various things. And okay, anecdotal evidence in scientific terms is the weakest form of evidence, but it is still a form of evidence. And I meet literally thousands of people like Ed who, you know, have something positive to say about cold water immersion. And you can even go on to say a placebo effect is still an effect. The problem we've got in the scientific side is that, of course, if you ask somebody who's doing something, if it's good for them, they'd be pretty stupid to say it's not. Because the next follow-up question is, well, why are you doing it? If you look at the science, there was a good paper published, those who are interested in the scientific aspect, on a review that started off, it's published in Acta Physiologica this week, actually. It started off with 931 articles on open water cold immersion. And after it had taken out those that were not particularly providing useful evidence, they were left with 42 articles, 24 of which were of some use. Of those 24, 15, there was high concern that it was a biased study. Some concern in four, and that left five. Three of them were to do with post-exercise immersion and its benefits for you, which is nothing to do with what we're talking about. And two had some positive benefits in terms of cognitive aspects. And interestingly, you know, the studies that have been done now asking people what the benefits of cold water immersion are much more to do with mental health and well-being than they are to do with physical. So rather a long way away from your question, but I think that probably there's something going on with mental health, and clearly that cold shock response alerts, awakens you, sets you up for the day, does, because you're pouring adrenaline, noradrenaline, cortisol into the system. I think the jury is still out when it comes to inflammatory responses, immune function, and other aspects.
You see, Ed just heard all that, and he wants you to send him those two articles.
You're sounding quite sceptical, Mike. You're very worried about the dangers of people doing things in a kind of cavalier way, basically.
Correct. So what I'm being is not sceptical. I'm being agnostic and cautious. And what we need is the proper randomized controlled trials done. If people think it's good for them, who am I? I'm not going to come along as the fun police and say, don't do it. Yeah. But what I am going to say is, be aware of the dangers. Make sure that before you do it, you're fit and healthy enough to do it. I don't agree with Wim Hof when he speaks into a camera and says anyone can do this.
Yeah. And so the biggest thing for our listeners is, you're not saying don't do it, but what's the sort of biggest do's and don'ts for our listeners?
We're a tropical animal. We want to be naked in 28 degree air. If you take that tropical animal and you plunge them into 12 degree water, that is incredibly stressful. And just as you wouldn't go and buy a pair of training shoes and the first thing you do, run a marathon, don't do the equivalent in terms of open water swimming. Go and have a health check. Check you're okay. Be aware that, you know, there are certain conditions that you really don't want to put that sudden strain on your heart and cardiovascular system for. Go with a reputable group. I do a lot of work with the Blue Tits, which are a big group around the UK and in Europe now. And they're really good. They promote safety. They get people to do this in a safe way. Do it incrementally. If you can start in the summer, if you need to wear a wetsuit, do it and then gradually build your resilience up. But try not to stay in for more than 10 minutes. As I said, don't rely on how you feel. And when you get out, get properly rewarmed before you do something like, you know, drive your car.
Such good advice, Professor Mike. Maybe one day you'll give me your mobile. In the meantime, thank you so much.
That's a pleasure. Nice to see you again.
To finish our conversation and give us some cheer, I'm delighted to say that we're joined by Nell Frizzell, who is journalist, author of The Panic Year, Square One, and Holding the Baby, and a affirmed outdoor swimmer. Nell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Affirmed, I like, not confirmed. I didn't do that bit of the swimming.
Affirmed and confirmed. Tell us about how your love of outdoor and cold water swimming began.
Well, I grew up in Oxford, and none of us would have set a toe in the River Thames back in the late 80s, early 90s. But then I moved to London after university and discovered something you'll be very aware of, Ed, the Hampstead Ponds, and completely fell in love. I was a swimmer at the Ladies' Ponds and then had this magical moment about sort of 5 years in of swimming all year round amongst these incredibly hardy 80-year-olds who just put me to shame. I got a kind of sly nod from one of the lifeguards who sort of sidled up to me on their paddleboard and said, do you think you'd ever like to be a lifeguard. And I've never been approached by MI5 or any secret agency, but this was definitely more exciting. And so then I became a lifeguard.
Tap
and it was
on the shoulder.
Yeah, the tap on the shoulder. And I then found out about 8 weeks later that I was pregnant. So I spent my lifeguarding career looking like a kind of elephantine lollipop in red shorts and a yellow sweatshirt and a huge bulging middle. And then the following summer, I took some casual shifts where I was still breastfeeding. And so I had this lovely moment where my partner would come and bring my son to the railings and I would feed him and then pass him back over. It was great. But I now live in Oxford and we don't have a ladies' pond here, but we do have the big old Father Thames, which currently looks like a kind of foaming, silty brown open sewer. But I'm still getting in every day and it's still incredible. And actually, this morning I swam in, there's a lake fairly near me that has a very handy sign that says no swimming that you can put your towel on when you go for a swim. And it was absolutely glorious. There was a collection of cormorants that looked like some kind of undertaking convention. You know, they're in their sort of somber, long black cloaks. And there was a golden, glittery kind of seeds and pollen in the water and lined by trees. And it wasn't too cold yet, Ed, is it? It's not gone cold.
No, 15 were most recently.
Nothing.
Which is
a bath, a warm bath, 15 degrees.
You've not noticed any strange mutations from swimming in this silty brown water? Have you got an extra arm growing out of your back or anything?
I haven't even got gills, Jeff. I'm really disappointed. All of this and I've gained no superpowers or anything. Probably a fairly iron stomach, I would say, and extremely sharp lats, but that's about it.
What was your experience of being a lifeguard at the Ladies' Pond like?
It's the absolute dream best job I've ever had. It was wonderful. From, you know, attending to the moorhens that had made a nest in our rowing boat to, you know, trying to talk a very polite older woman into the fact that she was actually having an asthma attack and she did need my help, because everyone is so kind and generous, they don't want to bother you, even though that's what you're there for. And then also the really fun things in sort of height of summer, turning up to, you know, unlock the gate and just finding sort of flagpoles of knickers and bras discarded, which was absolutely great and always really made me laugh. And to see, you know, friendships being formed and so many people going through really transformative periods of grief or menopause or, you know, new mothers, or, you know, teenagers. And I think to witness all of that is really amazing. And it reminds you that water, swimming, just being in nature is sort of fundamental to how we process, you know, our emotions and the world and our place in everything. So I've sort of carried that around with me ever since, I think.
Is that community aspect of it still part of your swimming?
Yeah, I mean, the thermos touting dry robe brigade of menopausal women, you'll find them everywhere and I love them. And I'm very proud to sort of be a young member of them. But I've, you know, travelled, I went to Berlin, France, Sweden, and you find swimmers wherever you know, if you are of that ilk and you're willing to strip off next to a sort of slightly puddly bit of water surrounded by geese and jump in, you'll find other people that want to jump in with you. And I think it's really beautiful. And, you know, there is a safety aspect, of course, about having other people there when you're swimming. But also for me, there's just the joy of experiencing that alongside like-minded people, whether it's the sea or a lake or a river. You will find your kind of tribe that way. And I have to say, we've been married for about 8 years. My husband has finally started swimming with a group of men. Imagine that. They get into the river together on a Sunday morning after years and years of me inviting him and him very politely saying no.
What tipped him over the edge?
Was it a midlife crisis? Is that what you're asking? I think another dad at the school said, do you want to come and have a swim every Sunday morning? And at that point, he probably could have said, do you want to come and play tiddlywinks in a car park every Sunday morning? And because we've got a small child, he would have been delighted to take up any offer. But he loves it, you know, and it's really, it's a nice thing that, because it is very female heavy, I think, outdoor swimming, or at least seems that way from me. But I like seeing the kind of Wim Hof men who take it incredibly seriously and they're like pulsing and breathing and, you know, being very rugged about it. And then there's always someone like me who's sort of slipping in an £8 secondhand swimming costume. And there was a woman at the ponds who used to swim wearing just rubber gloves. She didn't have any sort of neoprene. She just wore regular washing up marigolds.
Marigolds?
Yeah, marigolds and a woolly hat. And I think you can sort of undercut the machismo of wild swimming incredibly easily.
Are you listening to this, Ed? Because this guy is constantly Googling improving what the latest advancements in open water swimming technology are.
You're a gear guy.
I am slightly a gear guy.
Why don't you tell Nell about your little thermometer?
Ooh.
Oh yeah, I got a Zapper, which would tell me what the temperature was. Although in response, they've got a more accurate temperature. I think I can now rely on Dan's lifeguard, Dan's temperature gauge. They upgraded.
Is that because you believe that you should swim for a minute for every degree it is? I've heard this is one of those sort of rumours that goes around the swimming world.
I think it's a bit of an urban myth, I think, actually.
I've got a friend who does 65 strokes minimum, which I think is really impressive. She's Canadian and she goes swimming. When she was living in Germany, she'd go out with a hammer and smash a hole in the ice and swim in there and do her 65 strokes. Unbelievably rugged Viking woman that she is.
And you go through the winter, Nell, yeah?
Of course. Of course. I think when I was probably about 22, I met a woman. She was in her 80s and she just said, oh, well, one year I just sort of saw how long I could carry on for. And before I knew it, it was February. And I thought, OK, well, if she can do it, maybe I can have a go.
And you do short. But I mean, we've just heard Professor Mike on, who's given us very legitimate warnings about being careful.
Yeah.
Do you do it for short periods, long periods?
Oh, mate, I'm in for an hour and a half. I do a dip. Also, yeah. I should say, swimming in the river here in the Thames or the Charwell, this bit of Oxford, winter is particularly bad for sort of the old floating sewage and nasty sort of storm drain opening habits of our privatised water system. So I would, in the winter, it's not just hopping in and out. It's hopping in and out, not putting your head under it, not having any cuts, all of that kind of thing. But you can always find, you know, we're lucky. You can always find somewhere that is less polluted to jump in and out.
What do you make of the massive growth in open water, cold water swimming that there's been?
I'm horrified by it. They should all stop. It's stupid, dangerous and narcissistic, and I don't know why they're doing it. No, I think it's wonderful. I think I've never been more inundated with messages from people desperately trying to find somewhere they can go swimming than during the lockdowns. I think people were absolutely ravenous for that feeling of escape and freedom and trusting your own body again. You know, once things had relaxed and lifted and we were able to do our exercise outside, people were desperate to get to rivers and lakes and streams and seas and feel kind of liberated again. I would say, as a woman, I think it's really important to do something where your body is celebrated for the strength and resilience it has. And so it's like swimming is not about how you look. Sorry, Ed, I'm sure you look fantastic.
But they sent me a photo. It's magnificent.
But
definitely not.
I think after I had a baby, I remember he was about a month old and swimming through the sort of beginnings of ice and you can hear it cracking. And I was floating in this sort of completely frigid, cold, quiet, untroubled pond and thinking no one can reach me here. You know, this is the antithesis of all the responsibility of motherhood and the kind of chaos of hormones and the fluctuating anxiety of responsibility. And here I am just in my body, in the world. And it's such a magic feeling. And I think, you know, there's lots of research into effects on dementia and hormone levels and general sort of lifelong breeziness. I have no idea if it's going to work. Maybe my body is going to disintegrate in 2 years' time and I'll just be a pile of desiccated coconut. But for the moment, I think it's really helpful. I think it's really good. And I like the idea that I am using my body in a way that just makes me feel like a kind of Nordic hero rather than a product of sort of capitalism and consumerism and something to buy.
So it's that magic feeling of Nordic heroism rather than the list of benefits which are still being researched that you're interested in?
Yeah, I was doing this way before I thought about benefits. I just liked the feeling of being brave and being alone or being rugged. I've always wanted to be rugged. You know, for a woman who spends 8 hours a day sitting in front of a computer wearing two fleeces, I love the idea that I'm a very rugged child of nature underneath. I think it's great.
Us rugged children of nature, Jeff. Jeff, you too could be a rugged child of nature.
Yeah.
I don't think so. There's nothing rugged about me. Oh.
Your eyes could gleam like mine and Ed's. Exactly. Your gills could flap in the wind.
You're saying my eyes aren't gleaming?
Could gleam even more.
Something up with this filter.
Well, look, Nell Frizzell, we share this passion for outdoor cold water wild swimming. It's been fantastic to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Anytime you need a towel holder, Ed, just let me know. I'll happily stand by.
You're on.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet @cheerfulpodcast.
Whoa, ho, ho, we're in the outro, ho, ho.
Did all that good talk earlier, has that inspired you to make a nice autumnal stew, get a stew going this weekend?
Oh, that's a good question. What's a good autumnal dish? Vegetable soup. Pumpkin pie?
Pumpkin pie. If you want to go sweet, of course, the pecan pie is a classic.
Yes.
But just anything hearty. It's that time of year where you start eating heartily.
I think that is true. I mean, to be honest, I think this episode has sort of inspired me to do more cold water swimming.
I thought you were going to say to create your own gourd display.
Well, also that.
Some nice foliage around.
We're keen on foliage. Should we thank our guests?
We should.
I'd like to thank Kate Rue, Mike Tipton and Nell Frizzell. We love talking to them.
Emma Corsham is our audio producer. Rachel Barmer is our content producer. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made the iDance. Ed Seed composed the music. And our artwork was designed by
Henry Cull.
He's been Ed Miliband.
He's been Jeff Lloyd.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.